Hi, I'm Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American. Now, we have a special treat for you here today. Dr. Emily Bascia, a psychologist who's put a focus on trauma, also in working with a variety of different clients that include everything from terrorists, people who are on death row, all the way to clinical patients, has been working with The Optimistic American to try and help develop 7 different codes that we're going to put into a series of podcasts, trying to help you navigate through these divisive times. You know, with what's happening today in our political system, I really believe that a lot of what you see that seems so divisive and so negative really is hype that's being promoted by the media. But nonetheless, these are different times, and they're certainly big issues that we're going to have to help you navigate your way through, and sometimes where we need help navigating our way through. I hope you'll enjoy this podcast that's going to be focused on strength over safety. It's how the strongest steel is oftentimes forged by the hottest fire. Welcome. Thank you again for joining us. Now let's talk a little bit about hope. Dr. Bascia, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've done a lot of work, and we really appreciate that. You've done a lot of work on helping us develop the 7 codes. This first one that we're going to be talking about today is going to be how the strongest steel is forged by the hottest fire. Why we need to try and put strength over safety.
Yes, and that's a really important topic and one that I often talk to my therapy clients about. I want to highlight some of the research on this first, and just so we can define what is safety and how are we talking about safety in terms of how we've written about it in our book. So psychological and emotional safety is paramount. And we're not saying that one thing is superseded by another. But there is research, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which looks at more of a pyramid shape, establishing the basic needs first, which makes logical sense, before you can get to anything like self-actualization or finding your purpose and meaning in life. You can't necessarily do that if you're living a day-to-day trying to get food, water, shelter, safety, or physical health, medical issues. And that makes logical sense. So as we're defining it or talking about it today, I think it's just important to be clear. We're talking about emotional and psychological safety. And when we're referring to strength, we're referring to things like resilience, courage, bravery.
Right. And it's certainly important to point out when we have mass shootings in our schools that that type of safety is something that is a very different topic. We're talking about the safety that oftentimes comes in conflict with free speech, that comes in conflict with people being able to speak their mind and having different opinions. Now, as you know, I'm kind of a big believer that I probably put strength over safety to a more extreme degree than most people do.
Well, you're a unique one.
Oh, thank
you. Don't think that you have. I think that you lack the fear gene.
That may be true.
And you know, and that's why it's important to say, hey, it's okay to do things in spite of fear. We're not aiming for fearlessness. And we don't want to just devoid ourselves of our emotions. Our emotions are an important part of our being. Mm-hmm. So we want that information
to help
us.
All right, so I want to start with a story.
Okay.
The story I want to start with is my granddaughter, who you know. I'll try to remember to leave her name out of this, although I did speak to her based upon the advice of my psychologist, thank you, to make sure she was okay with me talking about her in this format. And she was very okay with
it. Important to get permission, yes.
Now, this story is a story where my granddaughter had called me up, and she had asked me if she could call up Uber Eats to get a cheeseburger. Now, we had all kinds of food in the refrigerator, so she didn't really need to go to Uber Eats, but it was something that she wanted. I get it. She's a typical kid. She's very, very bright. She's very smart. Although she, in her school with her colleagues, I often find that there is a high degree of them talking about safety. And it's safety in terms of how they deal with people that they disagree with on anything ranging from sexuality to civil rights to education. There's just a huge emphasis on that, both in their school as well as them as individuals.
And identity formation.
Yeah, all of those things. Now, she had given me a call, and she said she wanted to be able to get this cheeseburger, and I said, sure, absolutely, go get it. So she called me back in an hour, and she said, Grandpa, she said, the neighbor stole my cheeseburger.
I love that she jumped to the conclusion of somebody stealing.
Yeah, it was immediate, right? And I said, oh, what did
I'm
they?
I'm sure there are a lot of other explanations.
I said, did they actually come up on the porch to get your cheeseburger?
They robbed her of her cheeseburger.
And she says, no, the Uber place dropped it off at the wrong house, and they stepped outside and they grabbed the cheeseburger. And I said, well, okay, so what are you going to do? And she said, well, I want to order another one. I said, well, Riley, look, there's food inside the refrigerator. You can eat there. If you are hungry, you're not going to do without. But if you want that cheeseburger, if that's important to you, you're going to have to go knock on their door to get it. I'm not going to pay for a second one. Well, part of the story is that a few days before, my granddaughter had gone across the street, and she had listened to a conversation that was happening with the two young men that owned the home, and they were talking about things that oftentimes young men, well, it wasn't anything real overboard, but there was some objectifying of women going on inside the conversation, and she told me that that made her feel really uneasy, and she didn't want to have to go confront them. And I said, well, that's an easy choice, then you're just going to have to skip the cheeseburger and go eat something out of the refrigerator. Well, that cheeseburger was a mighty big incentive. She decided that she needed to go knock on their door. She went and knocked on their door, and sure enough, they gave her the cheeseburger. What happened was, after I spoke to her later on, she made the comment to me. She goes, well, really, those aren't that bad of guys. My point is this.
Because they gave her back the cheeseburger.
Because they gave her back the cheeseburger.
And they didn't eat it.
They didn't eat it, and they talked to her about it. They told her that they didn't know where it had come from. But the point is that it's my job in helping Riley grow and develop to make certain that she develops a sense of strength. Mm-hmm. And part of that strength is oftentimes confronting people who maybe don't say things that you really like, who maybe talk about issues in a way in which you don't agree with. And it's not about necessarily that you have to agree with them or that you have to concede mm-hmm. to their point of view. But if you can't learn to talk to them, it's going to weaken you. It's important for us to be able to build resilience in people, to build strength in people. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know, how do you deal with that with your clients and in psychology?
Well, just going back to that, I really want to commend you on encouraging her and not telling her what you thought she should do, which I think, you know, a parent or a grandparent might want to do. But you're really just allowing her to evaluate the situation for herself, evaluate her own sense of risk versus safety, and, you know, what are the consequences for not going on to the door or staying in home. She could have continuously been reinforced to avoid, which it sounds like, you know, maybe she has built up a high threshold and degree for that, avoiding anything confrontational or uncomfortable.
She definitely, before moving into my house, was conflict avoidance, and I've been trying to teach her the opposite, how to confront conflict.
So this was an opportunity, and it was a behavioral experiment. We don't know. I mean, maybe those guys were drinking in there. Maybe who knows what was going on inside their home. But, you know, she took that risk to go and see, and it was a behavioral experiment, and she was motivated by the cheeseburger, mm-hmm. Which is so important. I think, you know, we don't want to diminish the lessons or the value of the lessons in this example, because I agree with you in the way that you were describing it in the end, is that it does extend to what's happening in the college communities right now with cancel culture and woke culture, in being able to put yourself in an uncomfortable situation and just see what happens. We can't predict. Maybe it will be a bad outcome, and that's going to reinforce you to continue to do something else. But if you don't try and you continue to avoid, you're not going to know, and you're just going to remain paralyzed and stuck. So going back to your question about what do we do in therapy, you know, I often tell my clients the only way out is through. If you want to stay stuck and stagnant and continue to suppress and deny, you're not going to grow. You're going to stay exactly as you are, and your future is going to be predictable because you're going to know, based on your habits, where you're going to go. Margaret Thatcher has a wonderful quote. I hope I don't botch it, but it was something about, you know, be aware of your thoughts because your thoughts turn into deeds. Be aware of your deeds because your deeds turn into habits. Be aware of your habits because your habits turn into character. Be aware of your character because your character turns into your fate. And eventually that's what's going to happen. And so if we just collapse the time for your granddaughter, had she continued to live in an isolative world, just think about all the losses that she has given up on, that she doesn't even really realize or recognize at this point in time. I deal with so many people in that same situation and scenario. They're trapped because of something horrific that had happened to them, or some kind of trauma or some kind of grief, and they remain paralyzed by it.
There's an organization that is called the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's a group of people who are extremely concerned about what we're seeing on college campuses today. Although I don't really want to call it an epidemic. I think that way too often we create alarmism over issues that don't need to happen. But there's nonetheless a strong line of thinking that seems to be on college campuses today that wants to suppress other people's opinions. Mm-hmm. Now, in this particular group, they listed that over 591 acts of some type of violence or some type of suppression of speech have happened to their colleagues based upon students who didn't agree with their opinion. Now, sometimes those have turned very violent. There are teachers who have ended up with concussions and who have been beaten up or who have lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that is oftentimes these professors are people who don't even have the same means of being able to make money that many of these students will when they graduate. So it's not that they're rich people that are that are somehow or another abusing the system. These are professors. Sometimes they have a different point of view, but sometimes their views mischaracterize. Then the system seems to get out of hand, and all of a sudden they're trying to take away from them not only their right to say it, but oftentimes their job in it. To me, that's the challenge to what's going on with woke culture and cancel culture. It's the same thing that we're that I'm dealing with my granddaughter, which is, on one hand, you're doing a severe injustice to those other professors, but more importantly, you're not learning anything. You're not gaining resilience. You're not learning to deal with ideas that are different from yours. And you're also violating the single most important thing that exists in this country, which was the First Amendment, the right to freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm. But Paul, isn't the radical left just the same animal with a different disguise as the radical right?
Oh, I think
How
there's no doubt
synonymous?
About that. Mm-hmm. I think that the radical left and the radical right, assuming that we want to put labels on them, but people who are on the extremes of both political ends, have no desire to be able to have a discussion about their ideas. They're being empowered by the media today. They're being empowered by social, by the social media as well as the nightly news. The social media grants them a power to be able to try to cancel out other people. Mm-hmm. But no, I would say that they're both similar. How about yourself?
Yes. Well, I had a recent experience I have to tell you about. It was quite distressing, and immediately called my family and had to debrief about this. So I was driving a friend's car who has a bumper sticker on the back of it that says, I like Joe.
Uh-oh.
Right. So all of a sudden, it was really interesting. My intuition was kicking in, and I just felt this threat over on my right-hand side. Maybe I've got some like built-in psychological powers from all my risk assessments that I do in prisons. And sure enough, I looked over and I saw this man coming up and had a very angry, mean look on his face. He's pulling down his window and he's pulling up to my right. And I keep my window up, and all of a sudden he starts yelling and shouting, ranting and raving towards me, and then pulls out a sign from his car that says F-U-C-K Biden. Mm-hmm. So clearly I knew which camp he was in. Mm-hmm. I knew in that moment there was absolutely nothing I was going to do except try and just deflate the situation and you know, calm him down. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know what kind of risk there was. And so I looked him straight in the eye, I humanized him, and I smiled, and I mouthed the word, okay, it's okay. And he paused. I think he wasn't quite sure what to do with that. And then he continued again to just like press on, and again, this angry rant and showing me this sign. And then I looked at him again straight in the eye, and I said, I got you. You know, I heard you. I got you. I got it. And then he didn't know what to do with that. So then he made some kind of sexualized, vulgar expression with his tongue.
And probably the best he could do.
Probably in that moment. And then it stopped. It stopped. He just looked forward, and we were at a red light. There was nowhere he could go. There was nowhere I could go. And here
we were.
Okay,
I'm going to ask you about this in a minute. But yeah. I don't understand where somebody, how somebody gets to the point that that's acceptable behavior. No, that's not acceptable mm-hmm. behavior. You cannot pull up, not only to a woman's car, but to anyone's car, because they have a bumper sticker and decide to become irate. It's their point of view. You're entitled to your point of view. If you want to put your bumper sticker on your car, go ahead, put your bumper sticker on your car. But to me, it's the same thing as these college students mm-hmm. who take the position that they want to cancel out a professor, or they want to stop someone from being able to give a speech by going in and heckling the speaker, or by spraying mace. That's not acceptable behavior in a democracy. People are entitled to free speech, but not only did he violate the rules in terms of how a man should act, he violated the rules in terms of how a human being should act.
Yeah, and, you know, we share this space. We live in a community together, and I have a legitimacy to my right to whom I choose to vote for, as does he, you know, and he found his way to express it or in a way that was vulgar, trying to harass me.
It's trying to scare you.
I didn't show fear. I felt threat, but I didn't show him fear, nor did I show him encouragement.
What's going on with him?
Well, I don't want to make any assumptions because I really know nothing about him, or nor do I want to make generalizations because of the party that he belongs to or endorses. Now, it's interesting, when I looked at him in the eye and I said, okay, I heard you. There was no need to shout or yell. I heard you the first time. You know, it just kind of calmed him down, and it helped to basically emotionally regulate him. Because there was no other need to shout or yell.
No, it's interesting. You talked about the looking them in the eyes and the mm-hmm. dehumanization. I mean, we know from lots of studies of mass movements that oftentimes turned into genocide. That's actually mm-hmm. one of the traits that you'll see. People won't look the other people in the eye. They actually may know them, or they may have come from their same neighborhood or their same town. Mm-hmm. We had a guest on here. I know that you know Dr. Buscalo. Who talked about
how Buscalo, yes,
Buscalo, yeah. Who talked about his friends
survivor.
Wouldn't mm-hmm. look at him that were in the yes. same neighborhood that had arrested him. Also, when you listen to some of the stories that have come from professors who have been mm-hmm. accosted by students, one of them was a woman who ended up being knocked up against the wall, and it gave her a concussion and knocked her mm-hmm. out by mostly very, very aggressive young men who were mad about her position that was completely mischaracterized. But she knew some of the students, and yeah. she tried to look them in the eye, and they refused to. Yes. They refused to look her in the eye because there's a dehumanization process that's taking place.
Yeah, and especially if you're victimizing another person, as innocent as they may be, yeah, how do those two things coexist? And so oftentimes you'll see people wearing masks. There's been some research on sports teams and the things that happen and behaviors and violence that could escalate depending on what happens at sports events. And it's a kind of like you were saying, that group mob mentality where people aren't necessarily being identified. But if they were, you know, it would caution them. If you knew you were being watched, if you knew that there was some surveillance on you, if you knew that there was a camera on you, that might cause people to really think about their behaviors because they think there's possible consequence.
I'm not sure the success we're going to have in the mm-hmm. question I asked you of mm-hmm. giving advice to either the person in the other car or to the student who's decided to act that way. Hopefully we could.
I think we should look at the people in the middle, because All right. those are the people that we really want to focus on helping.
So what's your advice to them?
Well, I think arming them with skills Like if you are confronted with somebody who's harassing you, what are some of the situational factors that you want to have at play? I mean, I was fortunate enough, you know, there are things in the situation, whether it's distance, whether it's ability to like call somebody, you know, just ensuring that you're safe in your environment. So, you know, there's definitely a hierarchy of needs that are there that we talked about earlier on that you want to ensure you have. But looking somebody in the eye, not showing that you're afraid of them, because then they don't know what they're going to be encountered by, right? Because now you suddenly aren't this easy victim that they can target.
Yeah, I mean, this is traditionally the type of person who goes home and when he and his wife get into a discussion, begins to yell or scream because it gives him power. It's one of the ways he can win. And driving up to your car, I would just make a guess he thought that he could win by yelling and screaming and by shouting obscenities.
I'm glad that you mentioned that. So I do see that in the work that I do, the forensic work, the clinical work. People can feel really powerful when they're oppressing another person. And it's not uncommon to see people going from a victim to position to then becoming an oppressor, victimizer, aggressor themselves. It can feel really powerful, and especially if you no longer want to feel like weak or victimized or fragile. But what is inherently underneath that, I believe, is deep insecurity, is deep fear, is deep helplessness. Because these people want a sense of control. And so whether we're talking about radical, you know, extreme forms of, you know, the leftist versus rightist, we were looking at those. You know, one thing that seems common, and this is, you know, just a cultural trend and shift that we're seeing right now, those groups want control. Despite what they say, just look at their behaviors and what their actions are saying. Mm-hmm. They definitely want power and control, even if they're anti-power and control. Mm-hmm. You know, there is this authoritarian movement that's happening on both sides.
Yeah, I think they have a sense that at the end of the day, both of them, that they're a minority. Mm-hmm. I really believe that the majority of people are very decent. The majority of people do not act that way, mm-hmm. even whether they're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. They avoid acting uncivil to other people. And sometimes they avoid the conversation because of that. But it seems to me some of the lessons that we get from this, I like the idea of showing courage, looking the other person in the eye, but also trying to de-escalate it, that you don't, that's not really the appropriate time to have the fight in the middle of the road where people are yelling and screaming. But I also think it's important that we recognize, especially with college professors, I'm glad that the group FIRE exists, but you know, where are the other college professors? Where are the administrators? They know this is wrong.
To create
they know
the
buffer that it shouldn't
and protection
happen. But they become so afraid that those comments may spill over onto them because racist is such a powerful word.
And so is sexism.
So is sexism that they shrink from it. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, we need to first focus on a free debate. Mm-hmm. In a free debate, you generally find that people move to a center because in a discussion, it's almost impossible not to be drawn in by the other side. A middle ground is what we're going to always need to find if we want democracy and a republic to work.
And in order to do that, we have to at least have some kind of objective reality that we agree to and at least facts that we agree to so that we can merge to the middle ground. Because you can't change how a person's going to feel about a situation. You can't control another person's emotions. But if we can at least have some kind of shared understanding of facts and come to things with a scientific inquiry and objectivity, then we can at least have some ground rules for how we can have those conversations. And I'm glad also that you mentioned, you know, the middle is big. And sometimes it can be easy that, you know, we get so wrapped up in hearing the news that we think that this minority of people is actually bigger and larger than we think that it really is. But really, we're looking at two standard deviations from the mean. So the normal population, just statistically speaking, if we're looking at that nice bell curve, is about 64%. Two standard deviations from the mean, we're now starting to look at about 2.5% on both sides. That's a very, very small population that we're talking about. So I think trying to just, you know, get some perspective on...
You know, that's so difficult in an environment where that 2% gets overplayed, where their voices are amplified in social media because there's an advantage to Facebook or to Twitter or to other groups to run algorithms where negativity sells, in the nightly news, where when it bleeds, it leads. So consequently, we're hearing all this noise, and then we're seeing these people in isolated instances, and we begin to believe that maybe that represents a majority of the other side. I don't even believe it represents a majority of either side. At the end of the day, this the bell curve, as you're talking about, the group of people who are in the center, the reason that it's difficult to know that they exist is because we're quieter, because oftentimes we don't speak up. My advice is you have to speak up when you know that someone else's rights are being abused. If you don't.
I think we're also in shock, to be honest. It's hard to speak up when you're in shock. But there's the fight, flight, freeze response, right? Uh-huh. And so people freeze when they're in shock and disbelief about what's actually happening. But I completely agree with you. You know, if everyone who had been witnessing the atrocities and the Holocaust had stepped in, not just Jews, but everybody else who was witnessing and watching what was going on, and we may not have ever had a Holocaust.
Yeah, we can't allow fear to overcome us. All right, Dr. Bashaw, that was a very interesting segment. One of the things that we didn't get to that I wanted to, there's a great author named Steven Pinker who wrote a book called Enlightenment Now. Dr. Pinker, who is a Harvard professor, is also a very outspoken critic of the existing cancel culture that exists today. But I really like the point that he makes in Enlightenment Now, which is the world is in a lot better shape than you think. And he literally walks through all of the different things that are happening on the planet and comes to the conclusion that overwhelmingly, we are way too big of an alarmist on every single thing as if the apocalypse is coming for any one of 1,000 different reasons. And his point is, this is an Enlightenment era. There are a lot of really, really good things that are happening today. I think that the whole concept of cancel culture and what is happening in that environment is certainly something that I think it really does definitely represent a minority point of view.
You know, something that came to mind as you were talking about that, that I'm tending to see trends in, is this self-importance and, you know, ego-driven behaviors and ego-driven thoughts. And, you know, I think about some of the work that I do with the people that I meet with on a regular basis, and it can be hard to shed that away. People are so... you know, they're holding on to that, and they're gripping on to that as though, you know, they're standing on shaky ground. And I think there's been a lot of flux and change. And I think for people who are flexible, who are adaptive and resilient, they see opportunity in that. But for those who don't see security in change, they just see threat. They want control, and there is this almost ego defensiveness that comes up when there is this personalized threat and experience.
You know, it's funny. I do think a lot of that is age. You know, when you meet young people, they oftentimes think that they don't fit in, that they're not a part of it. As you get older and you start to watch how it works, you recognize nobody.
Yeah.
Fits in.
Right? Exactly. We're all conscientious about what we say and how we look and what other people are thinking of us.
We're trying to figure it out, right? And there is no power structure that is in place, not at least in a democracy. That doesn't mean that one group won't have the majority and then another group will get the majority and that ideas don't change.
Perfection doesn't exist.
But the Constitution was a living document. We are designed to be a more perfect union. That doesn't mean a perfect union.
We're
not even close. We're still trying to figure that out, right? Yeah. But our hope is that we become more perfect over time. And again, I think a lot of what you're seeing, anything from the guy in the truck who was assaulting you, I mean, I'm hoping he was a younger guy, I'm not really sure, but that was mad at you because of your friend's bumper sticker, all the way to cancel culture. Oftentimes those are young people who just don't know how to fit in, and they think that there's some other group that has power, and that if they could just get control of it, that they could fix everything. Well, in a republic, you're not supposed to just get power. You're supposed to share power with a variety of other groups.
Yeah, and if you think about, you know, who you are as an individual, and this is for all the listeners, you know, just think about for a moment who you are on an individual basis and all the different groups that you belong to and how you respond and act differently in different settings. There are so many different parts of your character and personality that get pulled depending on what is being called for you to do. And our identities are very complex and they're very dynamic and they're constantly ever changing. I remember one of like the biggest identity struggles that I went through in my 20s was the fact that I was both Arab and Jew, and that was that conflicted with itself because these were two groups that you know, are constantly at war with one another and denying the right to exist. And the legitimacy of one is constantly in conflict with delegitimizing the other right to live.
It's fascinating when you think about, there's a lot of talk about identity politics. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I think the way that identity politics has been identified, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's also important to have things that you can identify with. From a positive standpoint, I think being able to identify as being American and something that you're proud of and proud of our founders is something that adds an additional value. And it also becomes the glue that starts to hold us together. It's the glue that says you're a part of something bigger. And that thing that you're that you're a part of really is a terrific thing.
I think people, you know, want light and hope in their lives. And I think there's a large amount of people that do feel that and are optimistic about the current state of the world and their future. I think amplifying those voices and giving rise and bolstering opportunity for those groups can help bring some balance in what we're seeing right now. Yeah. So, Paul, I have a question for you.
All right.
So I know you have a real aversion to cancel culture and woke culture, but I know you have a deep, revered respect for the founding fathers of this nation and the development of democracy and freedom and our Bill of Rights and our Constitution. How the heck do you reconcile this with knowing that the founding fathers were also slave owners?
Okay. Well, maybe I let me start by asking you a question. How do you define morality?
Wow, that's a loaded question.
Sure.
Okay, so there's a psychologist, Dr. Haidt, who talks a lot. I love his work. He does merge philosophy with psychology and social science and really has dissected this question so much so that we're really left with very little. And there's a lot of debate right now in the field about what is morality. And the answer is there's no one objectified, unified definition of morality. But I'll answer it with a question, as most psychologists do. You know, the question is, what is sacred? What is sacred to you?
Yeah, I would start by saying, what are truths, right? Imagine in our Constitution, we hold these truths. Truths aren't facts, right? But the truths are the things that bind us together, that hold us together. Now, we both agree slavery is immoral, correct?
That's correct,
Why?
Yes.
Why is it immoral?
Because you're denying the free will of another person.
That's right.
And ownership of another human being through enslaving them.
All right. So let's take a look and think about this history, because this is a uniquely Western thought, a uniquely Western thought. This goes all the way back to the Greeks, who had a theory of themos. Dr. Fukuyama, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book called Identity. It's a really good book. I don't agree with everything in it, but he just does a wonderful job of describing this. The whole theory of themos was a theory that the Greeks had. It mainly related to their warriors, but it said that there was something special inside of each one of us, and that that thing that was special was entitled to a certain set of rights. Now, that this became the whole theory behind the Stoics with Plato and Aristotle, but it was unique. It said, what's inside of me, it has a set of rights that are granted to it, which sounds an awful lot like what was written about 1,000 years later, but nonetheless, these rights that are granted to me because there's something special inside of me that's an individual. Now, if you move forward to the Reformation, Martin Luther was struggling with this very concept. He was struggling with how did the church have the right to be able to sell him indulgences to get him into heaven? And he came to the conclusion that God couldn't be bribed. He said that there was something inside of each one of us as an individual that was unique and that had a direct relationship to God. And he said that that direct relationship with God had to make a binary decision. Either you believe or you don't believe. Now, move forward to, I think it was about 1760, there was a guy named Jean Rousseau, a French philosopher, who came up with the idea that that was actually also important from a secular standpoint.
With meaning the social contract.
That there was, he wrote the book, The Social Contract, or the treatise, The Social Contract. And in it, he said, government had an obligation to give dignity to each human spirit, right? And that social contract was a way to try to enforce that. So when Madison wrote our Constitution later on, he talked about it from a standpoint of creating the social contract where you would have the obligations of government and the rights of our public, and then the rights of government and the obligations of the people. The rights of government were outlined in the seven articles. Those seven articles outlined how you had an obligation back to government. The government could establish a currency. It could establish a common defense, that it had the right to establish a Congress and local governments, that it had the right to establish a court. Those are all rights that you're granting to government. And on the other hand, we had the Bill of Rights, which became the rights of individuals. Now, Madison, he definitely was a slave owner. Jefferson, who wrote those words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they're endowed upon by their creator with certain inalienable rights. That concept was revolutionary at the time.
Yes.
And it is the concept that defines us today. Later on, Martin Luther King would say that we should be judged by the content of our character, not by the color of our skin. Now, I promise you, you could look at Martin Luther and you could see things that in his life that you might declare were immoral. Right, that they were wrong, that they're not the things that he should have been doing, especially as a pastor. You could look back at Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and say, these concepts that you were espousing, why was it just men? Why wasn't it everyone? But the point is this, in that arc of history, they created a spark that put a focus on the individual. Now, the entire rest of the world didn't do that. In fact, about two-thirds of the world today puts their focus on the collective. They believe that some special group, a party or the oligarchs or a monarchy, should decide what's in the best interest of most people. And sometimes the things that they do to people, if you look at what Stalin did to people, slavery couldn't have been any worse. I mean, sending people to the gulag, killing millions of people. What was done in that name was horrible from a human being standpoint. Civil rights, equal rights, and human rights, they're important for the economy, and they're also important because those are the rights that we talk about that were granted to us. And it's the whole concept of Western thought. The only question that I have for our leaders is, did you move that concept forward or backwards? And if you want to apply all the other moral standards to them, then I think we ought to examine those people who are asking the morality questions about them, because here's what you'll find. None of us are beyond escape from, at times, doing things that we shouldn't do. But the question is, are you moving this concept forward? Are you moving those truths that we hold forward? And again, they're truths. They're not facts. There's another book called Sapiens, and in the book Sapiens, I love the concept that he lays out, that there are these fictions that we create as human beings. Religion, governments, even corporations. He said they're fictions, meaning that there's no other animal on the planet that thinks in that way.
You know, it's interesting. Right now we're going into the week of Shavuot, and this is the time when Jews had received the Ten Commandments. And I can't help but, you know, think about that, the timing of our conversation and the timing of this right now. Our questioning, of what is morality. And I guess it begs the question, like, if a society were to agree upon, okay, we accept the Bill of Rights, we accept the Constitution, we're going to abide by these laws because that is inherently good for our community, and at least we have some foundation. It may not be entirely aspirational, But at least we know thou shalt not, you know, kill thy neighbor, you know. So there are certain things that we can at least agree upon.
Right. It's a code, really, like, important. We're trying to help exactly. talk to people about today. I think back to George Washington. I love this. The men that were in his military couldn't get paid at the end of the war, and they were angry. They were mad. So they got together and they decided that they were going to try to get George Washington to become king. He went out amongst his men and he literally started crying. He started crying. Mm-hmm. He said, that's not what we fought this over. Do not ever give up these rights that you have for a monarch. Do not give them up for a king. Right? The only way that you preserve those individual rights is that if we collectively, as individuals, elect our own leaders so that it is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But that's a truth. That's a truth that we believe in. What I'm concerned about with the cancel culture is I think they're undermining the very thing that they're trying to base their morality on. Their morality of slavery being wrong, I agree with them. Slave owners being wrong, I agree with them. I agree with civil rights, human rights, and equal rights. Why? Because the individual is sacred. The individual who has a direct connection to God is due a responsibility from its government to give it dignity and equality. And when you undermine the founders, when you undermine the Constitution, you have to ask, well, what's left? Because two-thirds of the world doesn't buy into that.
Yeah, and I think it calls into question when you're talking about slavery and, you know, who gets to write the history books and, you know, questioning what's happening on our college campuses. I don't necessarily think postmodern theory is necessarily inherently a bad thing. I think there's a lot of beauty and permissiveness and inclusivity of diversity that it was essentially built upon. The concern is that it's now questioning rationality, it's questioning the scientific method, it's questioning objectivity. And so now we don't even have an objective reality. We can't even evaluate what is sane or insane because we don't even have a shared
objective. It's the problem to postmodernism. Mm-hmm. The whole theory of modernism is that we're going to base this on rational thought, experimentation. We're going to be able to take a look at
appreciation of individuality.
Things. And mm-hmm. that rational thought became a basis by which we could live our lives. To me, postmodernism,
Foucault was questioning identity, sexual identity, gender identity. I mean, it's the whole gamut. Everything becomes questionable.
Mm-hmm. And my answer to that is, again, I want to see civil rights. I want to see human rights. I think mm-hmm. that we have an obligation to be able to get to those things. But the way that we should get to them are through those truths that we hold, through modernism, through the belief that what we are espousing is right, that it is the right concept. But don't be afraid to allow someone else to be able to have a differing point of view. Have a discussion. Don't spray mace in the audience's eyes or stand up and try to get in the way of them being able to speak. Just try to make certain that the answer to free speech causes problems. The answer is more free speech. The more free speech we have, the more that we begin to find that center that helps us navigate our way. Now, your family, I need to ask this.
Well, I think the other part that we might be missing is that notion of invisibility, is that, you know, looking at what postmodernism provides and the functionality of it for these people who, you know, with the woke culture and cancel culture are really gripping onto, is it provides them a pathway to no longer be invisible. You know, they're not seeing themselves necessarily represented in whatever it is that they're learning, whether it's the theory, whether it's peer-reviewed journals. You know, I appreciate and have deep respect for the scientific method. And, you know, I just don't want to discard it and say, well, no, peer-reviewed journals mean nothing. There's a really deep process that happens in order to be able to get published in those journals. And, you know, it's important because if these people are feeling invisible and they're not seeing themselves represented, there needs to be some kind of an outlet. And I think going back to our point, what we're saying is, yeah, bring your voice to the table. Mm-hmm. Don't do so with physical violence.
And don't do so by cutting out somebody else's voice and by trying to make them invisible.
Exactly. You don't have to legitimize your own by delegitimizing the other. And we see that, I mean, that's the start of a war.
You know, so Eric Hoffer talked about this. He wrote a book called The True Believer. It's mm-hmm. a wonderful book. In the book, The True Believer, he says that no revolution ever starts because of people who have a lot and want more. Mm-hmm. And it never starts by people who have nothing and want something. It always starts from a group of people who have something and lose a piece of it.
And lose it, yes.
That whole concept mm-hmm. is something that we have to be concerned about if we care about the republic. There's no doubt that the deindustrialization of the United States, especially in the northeastern portion of the country, began to have a huge negative effect on white men, all right, who were put out of jobs, people mm-hmm. who all of a sudden didn't have work. All of a sudden, they were being set back. Now, political correctness has also had an effect on them. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be lost on people that what then happens is, especially through political correctness, is sometimes you make them invisible because they're not as good, especially as a college student, being able to stand up and to talk about their ideas. But just because they're invisible doesn't mean they go away. And sooner or later, somebody goes by them and they recognize them. They see them. They mirror them. They talk about the things that they are talking about. And when they do, that person will follow them regardless of how much they lie or how much they cheat or how much they steal. The cancel culture is not the answer to authoritarianism. It paves the road for authoritarianism. And that should be the fear. How do we maintain the system that's focused on individual rights? And that means that we have to give even those people who maybe sometimes we disagree with, a voice as well. Now, I want to ask you about your family. You yes. have a fascinating past. Mm-hmm. Your parents, your grandparents were tortured, murdered by Saddam Hussein. Maybe if you could just give us a little bit of that story, because I think it plays into this.
Yeah, so this was, you know, after the birth of Israel in surrounding countries in the Middle East, there started to be more waves of oppression and hostility towards Jews in neighboring countries. This was around, you know, post-World War II. Saddam Hussein started to rise to power, and he was very influential in the Secret Service, and he's of the Sunni Baath Party. And it was in the late 60s, early 70s that we started to see more rights be taken away and privileges being removed from Jews. They weren't allowed to own property. They weren't able to be business owners. And if they were, they were able to relinquish and take control and seize all of their properties, all of their monies. They froze assets. And so suddenly, you know, the Jewish population has been in Babylon ever since 500 BC.
Oh, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar yes. brought them in.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. you know, talking about slavery, you know, every Passover and Pesach, we celebrate and commemorate our ancestors who would survive slavery and cross through the desert of Sinai and came into Israel. So, you know, there's a really deep, rich history and a collective historical trauma, we can call it, that I was given. And I see that as a gift, not as a weight. But there is a responsibility. I feel a responsibility. It's drawn me to my work as a psychologist. It's drawn me to my profession. It's drawn me to the research that I do. It's drawn me to the work that
You've
I do
done a lot of
prison
work with
populations
immigrants,
and immigrants. And understanding intergroup conflict and revenge justification. This is all, you know, deeply rooted based on my identity and what my parents gave me and what my ancestors gave me. So, you know, there's just this deep, deep appreciation, profound appreciation and respect and gratitude. But my mother was young and she had just started college her father one day was going to the local coffee shop where a lot of the men go and talk politics and discuss what's going on in current events. And there was a lot of pressure at this point. Many Jews were escaping and going to Israel through different means. And it was just it was a dangerous time to be Jewish in Baghdad. And he was last seen being pushed into an unmarked car by men, which we later know was part of the Ba'ath Party. And he was taken to an underground jail facility.
West Side Prison or something like that?
Yeah, like West Side of the River or mm-hmm. something.
And it's a prison where, by the way, Saddam actually personally spent time torturing people.
He did, yes. With later declassified CIA reports, we were able to get more information about specifically what was happening in those torture chambers was the first word that came to mind, honestly, because that's what it was when I read it. And it was horrific acts of pulling fingernails from people, having them strung from the ceiling for hours by their limbs, and depriving them of basic needs. Electrocuting them, connecting electrical circuits to their genitals,
and
trying to get information as much as they could, and in order to claim that other people were foreign spies for Israel. You know, and it was very sad. There was a hanging of, I believe it was 9 young Jewish boys. Mm-hmm. They were minors. They weren't even adults. They were around 16, 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And they hung them in the common square, Tahrir Square in Baghdad. And my father was riding his bicycle, and he came across this and saw a group of people gathering, and he didn't quite understand, and he saw people cheering. And he came and he saw that they were the gallows.
And one of the young boys I know in the story that I read had been told by the court if he would just confess to being a spy for foreign governments, that they would let him go, if he would just admit to it. And of course, that's not what happened.
You know, there's no justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And
the rule of law was gone.
You know, it's disheartening and terrifying to even consider. Mm-hmm. And here we are in the U.S., and here we have all these rights. And I think people don't really appreciate or respect how people have died and fought for these rights and that we have protections. It's not a perfect system. And sure, people can complain about all that's going on. Mm-hmm. But can you imagine being 17 years old and you have no right to fight for your life? You know, your destiny is already determined by the government because they've chosen to execute you, and there's nothing you can do to avoid that mm-hmm. fate. And that determination. And it's just terrifying, terrorizing to even consider. And I think of my parents, you know, they're so, so humble. And they never want any kind of accolades or awards. They don't see what they did as heroic. And they talk about their story, and they'll minimize it, and they'll deny it, and they'll say, oh, everybody else suffered. Everybody else has a hard story.
Nothing. They left broke. They left without their parents. They left having to build
without
a new
knowing
life.
Who, if my mother left without knowing if her father was alive or dead. That still haunts her today. She will never say out loud. But it does, you know, and I can't even imagine what that would feel like to leave. Knowing that, okay, I have to live for my family. I have to take care of my younger brothers. And my mother depends on me. And I need to get to safety. Let's establish a house in Israel and constantly go, 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 go. You know, you're just in a constant survival mode. But they built a life. They built a beautiful life. And they built a family. They built a community. And then, you know, they constantly immigrated and they had to leave that behind. Then they went to Canada, where I was born with my brother in Montreal. We lived there and I had my childhood there. We had the safety. It wasn't, you know, there was no political warfare like you would experience in a day to day in Israel, or having, you know, you're constantly under threat, even though people do survive. They go to work, they shop, they get married, they have children, they build their lives. But you know that there's stress. There's mm-hmm. immense amount of stress that people live with in Israel. But it is so alive and so powerful and so vibrant at the same time. It's an amazing place. And then my parents immigrated to America. You know, that constant, like, up and leaving. It's so easy to just destroy something that you spent so much time creating. And it just takes a moment. It can happen in a flash.
Imagine this. First, I think this is important because I really believe that I should be an alarmist against alarmist. I think we're a long ways away from this happening in the United States. In fact, I think we're going to solve our problem. I think the rule of law is strong here. I think we have 200 years or 250 years of our Constitution working. And there's no evidence to me that it's falling apart. The evidence to me is quite the opposite. It has survived some horrendous things. Mm-hmm. But the similarities. One of the similarities is the dehumanizing issue, mm-hmm. right? The idea that Saddam took a group of people and began to dehumanize them. Now, again, I think the right and the left are both doing that. They're dehumanizing people, not the right and the left. That's not even fair because I have a lot of friends on the right and the left who aren't doing any such thing. The far right.
Let's say the radicalized.
Right?
Yeah.
The second
that
thing that I would say
2.5%
is understand the politician's agenda, right? Mm-hmm. This is the politician's agenda. It's to convince you that someone else is harming you, that someone else is taking something mm-hmm. from you. Now, the typical targets are it's the rich, or it's the immigrants, or mm-hmm. it's the poor, or it's the liberal elite, or it's the false news. But what you do is you begin to explain to people or tell people how they're being harmed. And you don't even know it when it's happening, mm-hmm. but you're becoming a victim. You're becoming a victim, and mm-hmm. once you become a victim, you lose your agency. Mm-hmm. You no longer have the agency. Mm-hmm. The politician has the agency. Mm-hmm. They own the agency. Now, mm-hmm. that works to their advantage. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get you to give up your agency by being a victim, mm-hmm. even though you may not call yourself a victim. You're seeing other people as having caused you your problems, so you can no longer fix it, mm-hmm. which means the only person that can fix it is this messiah that is standing on your back trying to take advantage of what you've done to be able to promote themselves. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, it's the single biggest risk we have. Now, my answer to people is start with this. Political parties, mm-hmm. the nightly news, social media, politicians, just understand they're not bad. Mm-hmm. They just have an agenda. They profit from trying to make you afraid, from trying to make you believe that you're a victim. We're not victims. The problems that we've created in this country, we can solve with the people who are in this country. Mm-hmm. They're solvable problems. And in fact, if you do a comparison, there's nobody doing as well as we are doing. Yeah. But if we allow people to continue to divide us and we buy into that, while I think we're a long ways away, we're certainly on the path to getting there.
You know, it's interesting. So my family story definitely compelled me to do the research on looking at intergroup conflict and how is it that one group can justify revenge and hostility and denial of human rights of outgroup members. And what my research found was people who believed in a vengeful God and were more likely to condone vengeance against outgroup members if mediated by this sense of victimization, victimhood, and a sense of mistrust that they feel like they've been abused by the world or others. And that is critical because that's that mediating factor. Without that, there was no link. And so I think it's important, again, to really look at and for people who are listening to this, you know, really question, do I mistrust the world? Let me follow my thinking patterns. And, you know, you'll hear it when people start talking to you. If they really feel like they've been assaulted by the world or others and everyone else is to blame, they're taking no responsibility for their actions. They see no sense of autonomy or control over what's happening to them. And constantly blaming the world. That's a dangerous person. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would just say, like, be aware if you're catching your thinking patterns starting to follow that, because that's not going to be serving you any good. Mm-hmm. And if you hear it in other people, I would say if you love them and care about them, call them out on it. Let them know.
Adolf Hitler and Winston Churchill, it's funny because they were both great leaders, mm-hmm. right? Meaning that they had huge followings and they were able to do unbelievable things in their country, for good or bad. Mm-hmm. So when you look at them, you have to say, well, what was the difference between the two of them? Because we know that we tend to put one as being a good person and one as being a really bad person. Mm-hmm. Well, one of them focused on fear, on hostility, mm-hmm. on victimhood, trying to make people believe that they'd been harmed by the other groups. The other one was talking about inspiration and how mm-hmm. working together they could make things happen. Now, I'm yearning right now for those types of political leaders that will look to try to pull us together as opposed to separating us apart. But probably my biggest advice to most people is quit watching politics. Quit watching the nightly news. There's lots of good things that are happening in this country. Pay attention to it. Pay attention to the good things.
And choose what you want to engage in.
Choose what you want to watch. Mm-hmm. Recognize that they have an agenda mm-hmm. to try to make you believe that it's the apocalypse.
But we want you to engage in politics. We don't
right.
want you to disengage in politics.
But
that's
you can
important.
Engage in the you can engage yeah. in politics uh-huh. and still be disconnected from the very negative messages that are being promoted by the differing groups.
Yeah, protecting yourself.
Don't
yeah.
see yourself as a victim, and don't let anyone else mm-hmm. make you a victim. Mm-hmm. Hold your own agency. Recognize mm-hmm. that the challenges that we face, all of us, mm-hmm. can make our life better. I mean, you've seen examples where people have done incredible things.
Look at the example of my father. I just wanted, you know, to give him tribute, too. He is so resilient and so humble. Oh, my gosh, if you meet him, well, you know him. But, you know, if anybody meets him right away, you just know this is like a jolly, happy-go-lucky, you know, he doesn't hold any grudge or resentment, and he has every legitimate right to be angry at the world, and yet he chooses not to be. And he went with his brothers, and they were they paid off some Kurds in the northern part of Iraq to smuggle them. You know, human smugglers taking them out, not too dissimilar from what's happening in other territories, to cross them into Iran. At that time, there were safe houses. This was before the revolution. There were safe houses there. And Israel at the time was creating some links and flights to be able to transport Jews who were seeking asylum, fleeing persecution from neighboring countries in the Middle East. And again, you know, just living a day-to-day existence, not knowing what their fate will bring, not knowing if they'll be reunited with their parents again. And then as soon as they got into Israel, they have a process there, not unlike what we had here, and they go through the process and they put them in the army and they determined what their strengths would be. And so my father was on three major fronts of the war during the Yom Kippur War. And in my eyes, he's a hero. Mm-hmm. He's a hero and the most humble of all heroes.
Mm-hmm. You know, most heroes are.
Yeah, yeah. He's pure. Mm-hmm. Both my parents, just pure, pure people, down to earth, salt of the earth. And I think, oh, my God, thank God for them. Like, my strength comes from them. My resilience comes from them. And now we have this, you know, collective memory. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about groups, there's a lot of psychological and social research looking at how groups create a buffer and protection against, you know, different forms of adversity and threat and terror. And I live it, you know, I live it. And I hope that other people can find that for themselves. It exists. It exists. It's there. It might be hard to find, you know, it's like, but it's there. You just have to be able to put the language around it, create the narrative around it, and you have to own it and you have to believe it. And most importantly, believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm. You have to own your own agency. You have
yes.
to control your own agency. You have to master your emotions. Mm-hmm. I love the story that you gave about driving and looking them in the eye
yeah.
and dealing with your courage. You have to master your emotions. And emotions can mm-hmm. have all types of funny effects on you. It's what causes people to be smokers or overeaters or to have sex addictions, any one of a number of other challenges. Mm-hmm. And we all have challenges being able to master it. But I think it's also maybe the most important part, and it was fun writing this one code with you. We'll be back to talk about, in other shows, the other six codes. But it's a recognition that the strongest steel is forged by the hottest fire, that the way that we're able to resolve our problems is by listening and communicating with other people and being willing to allow them to speak up even when we don't agree with them. Dr. Bascia, thank you very much for being
thank
here with
you,
us
Paul.
Today. We'll see you on the upcoming shows.
Thank you.